It's important to make know that we are not agree with the government, with this politic and the decisions it takes.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Jacob Goldstein. Today is Tuesday, October 11th, and that was Nathalie Edouard you heard at the top. She and thousands of other French union workers are protesting government cost-cutting measures.
Today on the podcast, we take out our crystal ball. We peer into the next 20 years and try and figure out, can economics help us solve the problem of global warming? We have that conversation with what I think it's safe to say is the world's most influential thinker on energy issues, Daniel Yergin. But before all that, our Planet Money Indicator with our very own Jacob Goldstein. What do you got for us?
Today's Planet Money Indicator, 5.4 million. The population of Slovakia is 5.4 million.
Did someone buy you a book of facts and you're just going to open it randomly?
Yes, this is a random Planet Money Indicator, but its very randomness is why it's such a big deal. Today, the fate of Europe's economy, dare I say it, the fate of the world hangs on those 5.4 million people. Slovakia's parliament is voting today on whether to expand Europe's bailout fund. And as of right now, every other country that uses the euro, that's more than 98% of the population of the eurozone, they have already approved this bailout fund expansion. But the way the euro works is every single country has to approve this before it can take effect. And so this fact, the fact that Europe and the world is all hanging on what Slovakia does, the fact that right now, just before we came in here, there's a link on the Wall Street Journal's homepage saying that they are live blogging the parliamentary debate in Slovakia, this points to this huge, huge problem that really is at the root of a lot of the European debt crisis, which is there is not any real central authority to take the kind of big dramatic actions they need to end this crisis.
It is crazy. This must be the highest point of attention the Slovakian parliament has ever or will
it's
ever
big
receive.
Big moment, Slovakia. Make that speech today, you know? Yeah.
And we've already gone through this with Malta,
right.
Estonia.
Malta was yesterday, yeah.
Such massive global powers. Yeah. So this is like the entire U.S. economy revolves on what would be a comparable size state, like Wisconsin?
Yeah, Wisconsin. And remember, 49 other states in our imaginary world, they've already approved it. You know, it's not like it's 50-50 and Wisconsin's going to break the tie. It's like 98% of the population has already said, yes, let's do this. Oh, but wait, we got to see if Wisconsin, you know, is going to jump in.
Yeah, and we in the U.S. have this amending the Constitution process, which was designed to be an incredibly difficult high bar, something we've only achieved a few dozen times in our entire history. And it's way easier.
Much easier. And, you know, this is a huge problem for Europe right now because this debt crisis, which becomes a financial crisis, it moves very fast, right? So yes, Slovakia will probably today or this week approve this expansion to the bailout. But you know what? It clearly will not be enough. It won't be enough money. It won't be enough power. So we'll be on to the next thing where Europe is sort of behind the ball and waiting for Slovakia and Malta and Estonia and everybody else to approve it. I mean, the only way out of this ultimately is you break up the euro fund or you create much more central authority. And either of those options would be incredibly painful and difficult, but there doesn't seem to be an alternative.
Wow. Thank you, Jacob.
Sure.
All right. On to today's podcast. So Daniel Yergin is the dean of energy analysis, I think you could say, something portentous like that. He's the head of the Cambridge Energy Research Associates. He's the voice on global energy policy, you know, the Saudis and Iran and, you know, the White House and everyone who cares about energy policy, ExxonMobil, they're all waiting to hear what Daniel Yergin says. And most of his time is really micro details on the exact movement of energy around the world. But around once a decade, he redefines the fundamental way people look at energy. In 1992, he won the Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Prize, which is the definitive history of oil. And it's about the big power battles that defined the 20th century, how big world leaders fought over oil. So his new book is called The Quest. It's equally well-written, equally delightful, equally sweeping. And I got to say, for Planet Money people, and I'm guessing a bunch of our listeners, it's probably more to our hearts because it's sort of the geeky companion to, you know, the macho world leaders of the prize. The quest is about the nerds, the scientists, the inventors, the people who've been tinkering away for a very long time, trying to come up with alternatives to this dominant hydrocarbon oil-based energy system. And Daniel Juergen and I started by talking about the race between gasoline and electric cars that started much, much earlier than I realized. You showed me a great photo of Thomas Edison and Henry Ford sitting around a table literally deciding cars be electric?
At that time, and Edison was the most famous American in the world. I mean, he was incredibly famous for what he had done, more famous than the presidents. There was a dinner in 1896 in a restaurant on Long Island, and Edison was the guest of honor, and there was a young man there who was an engineer who worked for the Detroit Edison Company, and his name was Henry Ford. And he was trying to build this kind of contraption that, you know, a mechanical horse, so to speak. And Edison couldn't hear very well, so they had Ford come and sort of almost shout into his ear. And he explained what he was trying to do. And Edison said, you know, you're right. That hydrocarbon, he called it, that's a good fuel. What he meant was gasoline. And Ford said that this was decisive for him in terms of his determination to, you know, finally leave his job and actually start making what became the Model T. Edison then decided a few years later that actually cars with all gasoline were too much trouble and really devoted himself to a battery for electric vehicles. In fact, there was electric vehicles called the Edison, but they never took off because by 1910, the race was over. Internal combustion engine, gasoline had won and the electric car was off the track. Now here we are a century later and the race that we thought was over has started again and the electric car is out there as a potential competitor to oil-based transportation.
I mean, you showed me a picture of a car. It's not a Model T, but it looks like, I mean, it's from that era where a woman is plugging it in.
And yes.
It seems so anachronistic. Yeah. It seems like it would be from today.
Yeah, exactly, because right next to it is a photograph in almost exactly the same posture of this CEO of Nissan Renault plugging in a Leaf. And it's like, you know, it's like a time warp.
I mean, it's a lovely thought to think like what this one conversation could have changed all of world history and eliminated global warming before it even began. But back then and today, there's something that gasoline has, its energy density it was probably going to win out over the battery, right? No matter what Henry Ford and Thomas Edison decided.
I think at the time that the energy density, you didn't have to, the energy density was there already. The battery would need lots and lots of improvement, and it still needs lots of improvement to really get large-scale commercial adoption. And if Henry Ford, maybe somebody else would have figured out how to drive down the costs and move towards mass production.
What's a realistic thing to expect? So right now, hydrocarbons are, is it 95%?
About 80% of our total energy.
Oh, that's it? 80%? Well,
but then there's nuclear and then then there's renewables. Renewables, if you look at our energy in the late 70s and today, renewables are actually about the same percentage of our total energy.
Wow, as they were then. I mean, they've grown, but so has gas and oil. And,
right.
So it's about 80%. And then how much is nuclear?
Well, nuclear in the United States is about 20% of our electricity. In Germany, it's 20%. In France, it's 80%.
And nuclear is really not a technological challenge. It's a political challenge, fundamental, or a safety challenge.
Yes, and of course, nuclear, the plants that were built in the 60s are not the same plants that would be built today. You know, so there's still innovation, and a lot of the innovation is focused on safety so that you have so-called passive safety features. So what happened at Fukushima wouldn't happen in a new nuclear power plant.
Right, and that... I sort of want to table nuclear because nuclear could actually solve a lot of these problems but might raise other problems.
Right,
that
people don't like. I mean, but it's interesting after the nuclear accident at Fukushima in Japan, you saw different reactions by different governments. Chancellor Merkel, leader of Germany, said we're shutting it down by 2022. The French said we remain committed to it. It's interesting the Obama administration said that we continue to regard nuclear as an important component because it is currently the only large-scale commercial carbon-free source of electricity.
Gotcha. So Of the other major renewables, which would be wind, solar, and biofuels, right? Those are the three major. What's a realistic expectation? What's a reasonable range for how much they could grow in the next 20 years?
Wind could have continue to have substantial growth, particularly if it's demonstrated that offshore wind works in a large scale. The problem is not having a technology. The problem is having something that works at large scale and it's competitive. And I think the Europeans are now going to test that proposition in the years ahead, because that's where they're making a very significant commitment. So we'll know in 3 or 4 or 5 years about that.
And what, you know, could that go to 40% of U.S. electricity, or is that crazy?
I think there's an ambitious goal that of getting to about 20% of our electricity from wind. Wind does
in
have,
20 years.
Yeah,
or
so? That's an ambitious goal. Wind does have a problem that it's intermittent. You can't. The wind doesn't blow all the time, so you need something else. And for instance, natural gas is often sort of the partner of wind and solar. I think solar, you know, may be the ultimate destination of where we go, but it's still a question of bringing down the cost and making it competitive again on a large scale. Biofuels went through a big boom, around 2006, 2007. But I think what we found, we're kind of reached the limit for conventional ethanol in our motor fleet on an energy basis. It's about 6%, so it's a big number.
Right. And there's a big debate about at least some biofuels, certainly corn ethanol, that they might actually be net negative or net neutral. They might,
yeah,
they might take as much energy to—
It's an incredibly vigorous argument about that. And what people are waiting for is the second generation biofuels, where you don't necessarily use food crops. You're not competing with what you're going to do with corn and so forth. And again, breakthroughs are possible. It may be tomorrow or maybe down the road. But I think people have found that it is tougher than they thought.
Let's go back to solar. I remember 10 years ago, I think it was you, but I'm not sure, said once oil gets to $30 a barrel and stays above there, then solar is really competitive.
No, that was not me.
That wouldn't have been you? Okay.
No.
All right.
Partly because solar and oil really don't compete with each other. Solar competes with coal and natural gas and wind, because that's in the electric power sector, and oil's over here in the automobile sector.
Right.
So
it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right.
But I think it is true that high conventional energy prices are generally helpful to renewables, because it makes people keener about them. Why did the first wave of renewables enter the Valley of Death? It's because oil prices in the 1980s, instead of going through the roof as was predicted, collapsed. And so they just didn't, kind of said, what's the point?
Right. Everyone thought they were going to be driving tiny little Japanese cars, and they all bought big SUVs, because who cares?
Yeah. And I have a great section in the book. I went back and said, where did the SUV come from, and, how it was invented? And it actually saved Chrysler. And it was, they said Chrysler was the most profitable automobile company in the country.
Right. Not permanently saved.
Yeah,
but
yes.
Right. If we get a reasonably large hybrid or electric auto fleet, then the battle between oil and renewables is more direct, right? Because you are competing kilowatt hours versus dollar per barrel.
That's right. If you get to the point where some significant part of our automobile fleet, and again, we're talking significant part, we're talking 2030 or beyond, because when we do our numbers, even the most optimistic case, it's hard to see more than 3% of the vehicles being electric by 2020. But let's say we get out there, then you have a different competitive landscape. I think it also changes the psychology about oil, because you have an alternative to oil in the transportation fleet.
Right. And is 3%? I mean, I live in Brooklyn in Park Slope, and I work in public radio. So as far as I'm concerned, all anyone wants is an electric car or a hybrid vehicle.
Right.
So I'm surprised to hear the 3% number in 10 years.
Well, because it just takes time for the fleet.
Right. The average age of a car is 10 years
now. Yeah, 7 or 8% of the fleet turns over every year, or maybe even less now.
So everybody bought electric cars, you're still talking about something.
I'm saying this is how it looks today. 5 years from now, it can look different. And we know that technologies can come and change, but it's just based upon what we know today and what we can see out there today and the lead time and the scale. So we could start selling a lot of electric cars. We're still in the sort of early stages, but it will take several years to start seeing their effect. By 2030, we could have a lot more electric cars.
Okay. So I want to stick with 20 years ahead. So and I want to see if I'm following where we are. So it's 2030, let's say, and our economy and the world economy is twice as big as it is now. We're generally feeling more prosperous. We have whatever's 20 years cooler than the iPod and, you know,
right.
Whatever.
Unemployment's down to 5%.
Let's hope.
Yeah. 4.5%.
Right. Having just got there the year before.
Right.
And as a country, we're using about the same amount of energy because we've doubled our energy efficiency.
And that would be a huge achievement.
Which would be a huge achievement, yes. That we're not. I want to live in the ambitious, hopeful right. universe of 2030. Okay. So now hydrocarbons they're in 2011, they're 80%. I mean, what would be an ambitious, hopeful goal? Would they be 70%, 60%?
Well, I mean, in our kind of planning scenario, we use it. It's about 75%, and that seems to be you see those kind of numbers in other analyses. Some people have it much lower and they have plans for making it much lower. It's just hard to see how you get there quickly and how you tell the Chinese that you want them to change their energy system quickly.
So 2030, 75%, that sounds kind of depressing to me. I mean, that in 20 years, a hopeful ambitious is to just have 5 percentage points less of our energy come from hydrocarbons.
I mean, that, as I say, it's a kind of scenario based upon what we know today. What's always possible, and I'm so aware of it in writing this book, that, of course, things can change, that, you know, there's a consensus and everybody sort of sees things the same way, and then something happens that completely changes the picture. If there's a lot more progress in bringing down the costs of renewables, then their segment can be greater, and with greater efficiency, you know, the hydrocarbon share can be down.
So I mean, there's some brilliant 23-year-old in Caltech who could upend all of this.
Well, I think there is, and I think one of the things to me that's really hopeful, as I see on all these campuses like MIT and others, is that 5 years ago, energy wasn't a topic. Now it's a very big topic, and it's really engaged both the commitment and the imagination of young scientists. And, this book, The Quest, More Than the Prize, is a lot more about scientists, about people who, you know, and the power of scientific creativity. And so,
right. The prize was about, I want to say, manly men. It was about world leaders and tough oil entrepreneurs.
Right. It was an adventure. It was more of an adventure story, I guess.
Yeah.
And this is one. It's a different kind of adventure.
A geekier adventure, which is what Planet Money is all about, geeky
and,
adventures.
Yeah, and, you know, let's face it, you know, geeks are heroes today. You know, who's the big man on campus? It's the geek.
Right. And geeks will save us,
yes,
right?
Yes. Geeks will rule.
Yeah. We hope. All right. But still, an ambitious goal is 20 years from now, really, I got to say, minor improvements in the
I think we have new entrants into the energy field, which are the venture capitalists. And they came in, you know, because they said, you know, look what we've done in information technology. Look what we've done in, you know, look at Google, look at Facebook, look at Apple, look at Genentech, all these companies. We can do the same in energy. I think they've found so far that it's harder, that it's more capital intensive, that it takes longer, it's more complex, involves more regulation. So it just doesn't happen as fast. So I think the seeds are all planted for change. And if we maintain a consistent pattern, we'll see it. Maybe it'll happen before 2030. But I think you can be optimistic, but I think what we need is a marriage of optimism and realism.
Right. So there are people who, you know, want President Obama to have a, you know, man to the moon kind of plan. And, you know, in 10 years, we will get, you know, hydrocarbons down to 50%, that kind of thing. Is that, I mean, if we had a 1960s style just flooding the zone?
You know, we were with the man in the moon or the Manhattan Project. You know, the Manhattan Project was trying to produce two bombs. That's what it was trying to do. The man in the moon was trying to get a couple of men on the moon. It wasn't trying to kind of change the foundations of our that underpin underpin our economy. So I don't think a man on the moon program or a Manhattan Project or a Marshall Plan is quite the right way to go about it. What we need is constant, consistent spending on energy R&D, as we need it in other parts of our economy. I headed a task force on energy R&D in the Clinton administration days, and you just see this volatility of this spending, and that's very bad for young people who want to pursue careers answering questions. So I think we need a higher level and a consistent level, and I think that is probably among the most important things that the government can do, and not try and, you know, to mobilize the whole economy, that would be a very tough order. And if you look at our politics today,
it's definitely not happening.
It's not going to happen. Right. I mean, the whole issue now, I mean, in our country and other countries are going to be dominated about cutting budgets and fiscal solvency. So I would say what really needs to be preserved is this commitment to the future, which is what research and development is all about, and in the energy sector.
Can't we have a law that if you're really, really smart, you can't work on Wall Street? You move to the energy sector.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Bring all those physicists back. That's right.
Right. Right. All right. So we've talked a fair bit on the sort of game theoretic issues with global climate change. That there's massive free rider problems. You know, it's great for the U.S. if everyone else does climate change appropriate stuff, and then we just feel the benefits. Is there a path to sort of global coherence on energy policy, or is it just China's self-interest and hopefully India's self-interest and maybe Brazil's will sort of drag the rest of the world?
I think there, you know, you can see the Chinese attitude. You know, one of the things I write about is around 2007, 2008, the Chinese started to have quite a different tone about climate change. And I was at a conference in June where I heard the president of China speak, and he said that there, you know, are three major issues facing the world. He says energy, food, and climate change. And you wouldn't have heard a Chinese president say that 5 years ago, even the same Chinese president who's president now. So I think that's a change. And a lot of things that we do that we don't call climate change policies have that impact. Doubling the fuel efficiency of automobiles is, among other things, it's not only about efficiency and reducing imported oil and so forth. It's also it's in effect a de facto climate change policy. Renewable portfolio standards, de facto climate change policy.
Just last question. 2040, 2050, 2090. I mean, forecasts 20 years are tough enough. Forecasts 3 months are tough enough.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
You don't even go there?
Yeah. No. All I would say, I think by 2040 or 2050, our energy system will probably look quite different than it does today. I mean, because then you'll have seen the impact of time. 20 years ahead in energy, given the long lead times, is actually a pretty short period of time. The elements of change are there. Indeed, all these wonderful geeks who are really, you know, obsessed with energy, but it just takes time for the impact to be there. So what I hope with the book is that it is, as I say, it's both optimistic. It's about innovation and change, but at the same time realistic. And you can see how these pieces all fit together and make your own assessments about where you think the action and the change will come. But one thing we do know, the change will come.
Please let us know what other books we should be reading, what other authors we should be talking to. You can let us know on our blog, npr.org/money.
You can also find us on Facebook and on Twitter, and you can email us at planetmoney@npr.org. I'm Jacob Goldstein.
And I'm Adam Davidson. Thank you for listening. Don't give up your energy.